Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, a show created at KALW with the support of listeners like you. As you listen to the programming you value, give your support to KALW's September campaign. Join us for the first time or renew your membership at KALW.org. Thank you. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Back in 1958, George Wallace lost his first campaign for governor of Alabama. You might be surprised to know that the NAACP endorsed Wallace during that race. That was before he became a proud segregationist. In 1958, he was considered a moderate. His loss was attributed to being soft on the race question. Well, 4 years later, he campaigned as a staunch segregationist and won. As governor, George Wallace stood in front of a doorway at the University of Alabama, blocking the entrance of black students. The seven-minute speech he gave in front of more than 200 national reporters didn't use racial supremacy language. Instead, he emphasized states' rights. Today's guest, Ian Haney Lopez, calls that dog whistle politics, coded racial appeals that carefully manipulate hostility toward non-whites. While it has evolved over the years, there are striking parallels to what we are facing today. Ian Haney Lopez joins us to talk about his new book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Ian Haney Lopez is professor of law at UC Berkeley and senior fellow at Demos, and he joins us from the studios of UC Berkeley's School of Journalism. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
Good morning. Well, I got a chance to read your book. Really interesting work, and I loved all of the history. First off, tell us, how do you explain dog whistle politics? What is it exactly?
Well, actually, I think that the way you introduced the subject with the story of George Wallace is a perfect introduction to dog whistle politics in the contemporary moment. So the point of that story is that Wallace wanted to be elected. He was outflanked on the right by somebody who was racially reactionary. And when he lost his first election, he vowed that no one would ever be more reactionary than him on the race question. And he tacked far to the right racially and then won a series of elections. He actually ran for president several times on the basis of these racial appeals. And this is an incredibly important lesson because it's the lesson that just about every Republican candidate out there has learned from Donald Trump. Whether Donald Trump wins or loses in November, he ran the field on the Republican candidates, a pretty deep pool of Republican presidential candidates, by outflanking them on the right racially. And that's what we're going to see happen over the next decade or two, because people have learned that that can help you win Republican primaries.
Well, okay, since you brought up Donald Trump, I was going to keep this until a little later in the show, but let's just dive in and talk about this. Can you talk about some of these coded messages that we hear from Donald Trump? What stands out for you based on the research that you did for Dog Whistle Politics?
Well, first, he's drawing heavily on Richard Nixon's coded messages. So he's picked up on the language of the silent majority. He structured his entire Republican convention speech around law and order. Those are themes that were really developed by Richard Nixon. And we should be clear what we mean here by dog whistle politics. Dog whistle politics is a way of talking in code. It's communicating powerful messages, but underneath, sort of below the surface. On the surface, the references are all neutral, for example, neutral about race. So you think about law and order, silent majority, make America great again. These are phrases that on their surface don't directly reference race. And yet right underneath, there's a strong racially provocative thesis that something has happened in America, that civil rights or immigration and demographics, that the presence of people of color is degrading the country, that crime is on the rise, that people of color are dangerous criminals and need to be controlled. There's a highly racialized message that's just underneath the surface of this superficially race-neutral language. And so we're seeing, we saw Richard Nixon, George Wallace pioneer with states' rights. States' rights, which is about the relationship of the federal government to the state governments. But of course, everybody understood at the time that states' rights meant the right of southern states to resist federal mandates that they integrate their schools. And then we go from there to law and order, silent majority. Ronald Reagan would talk about welfare queens. You'd get the Willie Horton ad about this black rapist of a white woman, but of course the ad itself never mentioned black or white. It just showed photos. You get Mitt Romney's Makers and Takers, Newt Gingrich talking about President Obama's the greatest food stamp president in the history of the country. All of these are dog whistles. Illegal alien, I'd say, is another very powerful one. Mm. On its surface, race neutral, just underneath, a very sharp jolt of racial fear.
And what we get from this is politicians who win elections based on a lot of this coded language they use. And as you write, these people are backed by massive wealth. They manipulate racial appeals to win elections and win support for regressive policies that help corporations and the super rich, and in the process wreck the middle class. You don't really hear them talk much about that unless they're asked. And unfortunately, in this race, we're not really getting many questions about these issues.
No, in fact, on the contrary, Donald Trump is running around presenting himself as a populist. Mm. And this, too, is part of dog whistle politics. It really goes back to Richard Nixon. Always there's been a concern about the elite in American politics, especially after the age of the robber baron and then the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression. But the elites were conceptualized as economic elites. The evil genius, if you will, of Richard Nixon was to see that the elites could be reconstituted as cultural elites. They would be professors. They would be members of the media establishment. They would be the sort of educated Northeastern folks. And Richard Nixon really described himself as a populist by recasting elites as cultural elites. And you see that has been a prevalent theme in Republican Party politics since, and it's certainly a theme of Donald Trump. I mean, here's a guy who was born with $1 million spoon in his mouth and has had millions to play with and is a self-proclaimed billionaire, and yet he presents himself as one with the working people. Why? Because he says the real enemy of the working people, the real elites that they need to fear are the cultural elites who look down on them, the writers for the New York Times, professors at Berkeley, that sort of journalists, right? That we've become the enemy of the working people, with nobody really talking about the class politics of Donald Trump and the class politics in particular of racial fear-mongering.
And NPR had a piece recently about the different tax plans between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We're finally starting to get some policy information out there. And, I mean, Donald Trump's tax plan benefits the top 1%. And so I would love it if when his voters are interviewed, for the reporter to say, well, how are you going to, how is Donald Trump going to help you with some of your struggles when his tax policy goes to the 1%? But we're not really getting that angle.
No, I think that's exactly right. Let's back up for a second, because I think that it's hard to understand, at least initially, what the connection is between race and class, or between a set of racial appeals based on fear and resentment of minorities and support for policies that really benefit the 1%, or in Trump's case, the 0.01%. So what happens, and this happens really especially under Ronald Reagan, is the right has tried to translate and been quite successful in translating hatred and fear of people of color into distrust and resentment of government itself. And the way it's done so is by saying, government, Democrats, liberals, major social institutions like unions, they really care about people of color. They're pushing integration on you. They're always talking about discrimination against blacks and browns. They don't really care about you, white working class. And the way you can see this is all of that welfare going to undeserving minorities, plus the government refuses to control them through lax criminal law or the contemporary version through lax border enforcement. And so fear minorities and also resent the government. Trust instead the marketplace. And that's one, two, three. Fear minorities, resent government, trust instead the marketplace. And this is the politics that helps explain how, from Reagan on, you've seen broad popular support among white voters for policies that essentially transfer massive wealth to the very rich. And nobody better personifies that than Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump's running around saying, we're going to build a wall along the Mexican border. We're going to ban all Muslims. But in fact, his only substantive policy proposal is to slash taxes for the very rich, by some estimates, by a third, taking us back to tax levels last seen in the 1800s. That's the only thing he's actually promising to do. And yet he's building a lot of popular support. I mean, a recent poll just came out today. 57% of likely white voters support Donald Trump compared to 33% supporting Hillary Clinton. Why? Because he's going to slash taxes for the rich? No, they hardly appreciate that fact at all. Instead, they support him because of his politics of racial resentment. But it's a politics that ensures their impoverishment and difficult life circumstances for their own children.
How do you explain this? Is it media coverage? Is it because they don't have a real alternative in the Democratic Party?
I think it's a variety of things. It's certainly the media is part of it. Certainly the Democratic Party is part of it. But I think most fundamentally, we have stopped as a country having a conversation about what race is doing nationally in terms of our self-conception, in terms of our sense of we the people, in terms of our relationship to government. We just haven't been having that conversation. And here, I guess, well, actually, let me make a distinction. What has the national conversation been on race for the last 50 years since the civil rights movement? And I would say there are basically three conversations. Dominant conversation on the right has been this dog whistle story. The major social institutions are helping undeserving minorities and don't care about you. Turn against everything public, support instead the private market and the wealthy family dynasties and wealthy corporations. The main conversation among liberals, let's say, has been silence. It's been utterly absent. Liberals have essentially adopted the idea that we shouldn't talk about race, that talking about race is itself divisive. And this is the way liberals are always attacked by conservatives, that if you talk about race, if you talk about diversity, if you talk about affirmative action, you're being divisive, you're even being racist. So liberals have stopped talking about race. And then there's this third strand of the conversation among, let's say, more activists, the sort of civil rights activists who have been fighting these rearguard actions to try and protect the gains of the civil rights movement. But even this community has stopped short of saying the harms of racism aren't just harms to communities of color. More fundamentally, they're harms to our sense of whether we're all in this together. They're harms to our sense of the appropriate role of government. They're harms to the working class in general of every color. And so what you're seeing now is this renewed effort to spark a national conversation on race that isn't just the coded rhetoric of the right, that really comes back and says, race is the fatal shackle in American politics. We remain tied to racial divisions, and those racial divisions are causing us to turn on each other and to fight each other rather than to focus on the increasing power of the wealthy over our society and over our marketplace and democracy.
You write, racial attacks on liberalism shifted the enemy of the middle class from big money to lazy minorities. I mean, you hear this all the time. And I really appreciate, Ian, in your book saying that the people who say these things are not bad people. In fact, they're good people. I know some very nice people who talk like this. You write that it's also been transmuted economic programs that helped to build the nation into welfare for undeserving groups. Why did you decide to really make that point in your book, that people who believe in these issues and talk like this are not necessarily bad people?
So I want to make a distinction there between people like Donald Trump, people like Karl Rove, even Mitt Romney, when he used the makers and takers language. I want to make a sharp distinction between the people who are strategically using these phrases and the people who draw on them as a sort of a common sense without really thinking about them. I think the people who strategically use that sort of language ought to be condemned in the strongest possible language. This is wildly destructive of society. I think it's deeply immoral to campaign for office in a democracy by stimulating the basest instincts in the populace, right? And so I want to be absolutely clear. I don't think Donald Trump's a good person. I think he's deeply immoral. I think he's an egoist. I think he's pursuing power by whatever means necessary at whatever cost to us as a society. But I want to make a distinction between Trump and the bulk of his supporters. Not all of them. Recent poll came out showing that 7% of Donald Trump supporters think he's a racist and support him anyway. Okay, if in 2016 you're running around saying, you know what, I believe in white supremacy, that's messed up. You got something wrong with you. You know, you know that that is deeply immoral, but you've embraced that position anyway. And there's that element in Trump supporters, right? The ones who spit on protesters, the ones who punch protesters, the sort of vitriol that you see among some of his supporters. That's not the great bulk of his supporters. I think the great bulk of his supporters, and I would say something like close to the majority of whites in this country, they're decent folks. They're hardworking folks. They love their families. They love their kids. They want to do what's right. They want to do what's moral. And at the same time, they're anxious about the way in which society is changing. And part of that anxiety is economic. Working people have lost tremendous ground over the last 40 years, and the rich have become so much more wealthy. But at the same time, part of that anxiety is stimulated by demographic change. Somebody born in the 1960s was born at a time when the United States was more or less 90% white. Because of segregation, they probably grew up in a place in which they didn't know any people of color. That America barely exists anymore. And in the transition, and this is really remarkable, we are moving from being a white-dominated country founded on ideas of white superiority to being a no-majority race society that actively embraces the ideal of racial egalitarianism. This is a huge shift. But in the process of that transition, people are going to be anxious, people are going to be fearful, and disastrously, some of our leadership is going to seize on that anxiety to try and stimulate it and provoke it for their own ends. But I think that we need to make this distinction between the sort of the moral evil and of this strategic racism, these dog whistlers, and the basic decency of our fellow Americans. Because at root, the only way forward for us as a society is to recognize the shared decency of all of us across racial lines. And this means that Trump supporters need to be able to look across the white, non-white divide and see other people who love and feel pain the same way they do. And those of us who are looking at Trump supporters need to look across that divide and say, we see that they're fearful. We think they're making the wrong decision in supporting a demagogue, but we know that they feel pain and feel love the way we do. We're basically the same. Now, how do we build bridges?
Ian Haney Lopez is author of the book Dog Whistle Politics: How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Ian is professor of law at UC Berkeley, and he describes dog whistle politics as coded racial appeals that carefully manipulate hostility toward non-whites. We've all heard this. In fact, we might have family members who say these things. What are your thoughts on Ian's arguments about dog whistle politics? What are your thoughts on this issue? And wow, what we're facing right now, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How do you explain Donald Trump's ability to turn himself into a populist when his tax policies would benefit the top 1%, 1/10 of 1%? What are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you'd like to talk about the dog whistle politics that you have seen over the past couple decades, we'd love to hear from you. And Ian, I want to go back to George Wallace, because you've got such interesting stories about him. I didn't know this about him. Where did he come up with this? And then how did, you know, what went on behind the scenes? So you write that George Wallace at first was a racial moderate. He sat on a board of trustees of a prominent black educational enterprise. He refused to join the walkout of Southern delegates from the 1948 Democratic Convention when they protested the adoption of a civil rights platform. He called a black lawyer Mr. in a courtroom, and this black lawyer said he'd never been called Mr. before. And then when he lost, he said, all right, he thought he lost to race, and he did a complete 180. I mean, he started using the N-word. So where did that come from?
I think it really, this is, Wallace marks the beginning of a major shift in American race politics. So let's emphasize that. We as a country did not come to repudiate white supremacy until pushed to do so by the civil rights movement that really gained momentum after World War II, the late 40s, the 1950s, with major decisions like Brown versus Board of Education, and the 1960s. So it's really in the civil rights era that we as a country, for the first time as a whole, not every part of it, not every person, but as a whole, we as a society said, we're going to turn away from white supremacy. Now, one result of that is that that pushed the question of people's support for or opposition to white supremacy to the forefront. And in the South in particular, room for racial moderates among whites began to close, because there was so much fear and anger towards this idea that white supremacy would be dismantled, would be disfavored culturally, would be dismantled in its social institutions, the segregated water fountains, the segregated schools. George Wallace, caught in that moment, is, I would say, an immoral politician. That is, he's got a set of priorities about what he'd like to achieve, but more than anything else, he wants to get elected. And if, in order to get elected, he has to pander to these base instincts, he has to pander to white supremacy, then he'll do so. And so that's what he does when he runs for re-election in 62, when he's initially inaugurated in 63 and begins talking about segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. But Wallace is astute enough to realize that precisely because we were beginning to shift as a society, that we were beginning to repudiate white supremacy, that he could not continue to use the naked language of racial hatred and racial solidarity, that he would have to find some way to both appeal to a sentiment of white solidarity, but also to disguise it so that it didn't seem so clearly to violate the emerging cultural norms that said that white supremacy was immoral. That's the origins of dog whistle politics, to find a way to signal white solidarity without running afoul of the major cultural norm that said white supremacy is immoral. So this is where you see Wallace starting to use the language of states' rights. There's a language of freedom of association. Again, this sort of philosophical abstraction. We all get to be friends with whoever we want, when in fact everyone knew freedom of association meant at the time the right of white businesses to continue to exclude African Americans. This is the origin of Dog Whistle Politics. When we look at Trump, 50 years have gone by now. We are much, much further along in that transition to a no-majority race, racially egalitarian society, and nothing better symbolizes that than the election and re-election of Barack Obama. But at the same time, that racial fear and racial anxiety among many whites continues, and it continues to be available as a political weapon that can be exploited by immoral politicians. Now along comes Donald Trump, and we should be clear, Donald Trump was the most egregious. But if you think about the sort of the dog whistling of Marco Rubio, who is insinuating that Obama was secretly a Muslim and had secret loyalties to ISIS, if you think about the dog whistling of Ted Cruz, who described the border as a scorpion, and we have got these scorpions coming across the southern border, and they've got to be crushed. Right? The whole Republican field was dog whistling. It's just that Donald Trump was out even further with his statements about banning all Muslims and about building a wall on the Mexican border. It's still the same sort of politics, appeal to racial fear in the context of a society that is making this transition to a no-majority race, racially egalitarian society. So for the rest of us, we have to say, what is this ideal that we're trying to achieve, and how do we best achieve it? And how do we address these political forces that seek to retard that progress, indeed that seek to drag us back? And that's the challenge, I think, that we're facing with Donald Trump. And frankly, that's the challenge that we're going to continue to face for the next 10 or 20 years, because you're going to see this sort of reactionary racial politics in every district in which there's a supermajority of whites and a Republican feels like the way to win the primary is to run as a racial reactionary.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I'm speaking with UC Berkeley professor Ian Haney Lopez. He's author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. He writes about how politicians backed by concentrated wealth manipulate racial appeals to win elections and support for regressive policies that help corporations and the super rich. And this is happening all across the country, especially at the state levels. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Ian, because we were talking about George Wallace, one of our listeners couldn't stand the line. She wanted to get your opinion about the fact that some African Americans in the South actually liked George Wallace, even after he did his 180.
I don't have much of an opinion on that. I don't know what that's based on. I think that Wallace, before he pivoted, had African American support. He was in fact endorsed by the NAACP. But the George Wallace of 1962 and afterwards is a fervent white supremacist and an outspoken white supremacist. I think that support in the black community plummeted. I know that only later in the 70s and later in the 80s did he come to apologize for the positions he took. And there was some sort of an effort to apologize to the African American community. But I don't think he had very much support at all among African Americans in the 60s.
All right. Well, thank you for that question, Kathy. Let's go next to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Morning, Rose, and thank you. Thank you so much for this important show, and I really appreciate your guest's analysis of the race card, so to speak. So what do you think of Donald Trump's announcement about paid family leave? And the other question is, do you think also his defense of the Second Amendment is part of this dog whistle politics?
Both really great questions. I think that what's happening is that, and it's late and sorry, but what's happening is that Trump is actually for the first time trying to say, oh, hey, you know what? I actually have some policies other than cutting taxes for the rich. Let me make some up. Right. And what's remarkable is how late in the process this is coming. When Hillary Clinton announced that she was first running, she did so by having a series of policy speeches. I mean, she got her policies out right up in front, 2015. Here are my policies on immigration. Here's what I'm going to do on voting. Here's what I'm going to do on mass incarceration. She had a series of policy papers. Donald Trump has been consistently campaigning on themes of racial fear. And it's only now, 8 weeks before the election, that he comes up with a policy that might actually help people. So I think that this is politics. This is political posturing. It's still astounding that it's coming so late. The Second Amendment business, that I think is part of Trump's strategy to run a campaign with almost no organization and almost no budget for advertising. What he does is he makes very provocative statements that then generate a tremendous amount of free press coverage. And the statements are not going to generate that press coverage unless they're provocative. Now, if they're too provocative, he ends up playing the innocent, and he says, what do you mean? You're misinterpreting it. All I said is Second Amendment people will know what to do. I don't, and I just, I was just referring to them organizing. You all are reading this other stuff into it. It's part of his strategy. And I think that that's what's happening with respect to race also, also with respect to gender. Right, to make provocative comments, to really push the media's button. He's almost, Donald Trump is this professional political troll, and he's going to troll the media, troll the Democrats, get people riled up and outraged. That generates a lot of airtime for him. Indeed, it almost displaces attention to any other candidate. And this has certainly worked for him during the Republican primaries. And frankly, it's been working ever since the conventions. And then if he goes too far, he walks it back a little bit and says, I was misunderstood, and he goes on to the next provocation. It's just part of his strategy.
And according to Truthout, the NRA is spending $6 million in TV ads on behalf of Donald Trump. Thank you for calling in, Mo. Let's go next to Paul in Vallejo. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I want to double underline and bookmark the use of the term no majority population. It's the biggest thing in the media that I hear. Even my idol Terry Gross still says we're going to be a minority in 2050 instead of no majority population. And I hear it on the media all the time. It stokes general fear in those who are fearful about racial content of the United States.
That's absolutely right, Paul. And to really explain the point, the idea of whites becoming a minority is implicitly rests on the idea that all non-whites will now be this monolithic majority. And so what it does is it takes a white over non-white hierarchy and it inverts it. And it says, be very afraid, because by 2050, the white over non-white hierarchy is going to flip. And now non-whites are going to be this monolithic whole that's on top of whites. And it continues to reflect a sort of a sense of white versus non-white. And at the same time, it wildly misdescribes our society. There is no emerging monolith which is going to dominate any other racial group. Instead, what we're seeing is the emergence of lots of different groups, lots of different races and ethnicities and cultures. And I think that this is, and even more important, it's not just that the number of races are proliferating. It's that we as a society are repudiating the idea that we should love, trust, or fear, hate on the basis of race. And so, as we become more heterogeneous, race will and should have less and less significance. It should no longer be a basis for organizing entrance to jobs or to neighborhoods or to schools. And there's going to be a whole lot more cultural fluidity, too. Race should not be held to determine your values, your culture, the foods you eat. That's what we mean when we say we're moving to a no-majority race, racially egalitarian society. No more dominant race, and no more sense that race should be the primary organizer of our social institutions and of our cultural and familial lives.
Ian Haney-Lopez is professor of law at UC Berkeley. We're talking about his new book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. He writes that examples of dog whistling include repeated blasts about criminals and welfare cheats and illegal aliens. Specifically, these provocations have nothing to do with race, yet they powerfully communicate messages about threatening non-whites. In the last 50 years, he writes that dog whistle politics have driven broad swaths of white voters to adopt a self-defeating hostility toward government. In the process, remade the very nature of race and racism. Politics today cannot be understood without recognizing racism's evolution. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, leave a comment on our website, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Thank you for calling in, Paul. Let's hear next from Mary in Oakland. Hi, Mary.
Again.
Oh, do we lose Mary? Mary asked, what are the Democrats doing to contradict Donald Trump? I mean, Hillary got into a lot of trouble for calling Trump's supporters deplorables, regardless of what you think of them. A lot of people said, why would she do that, knowing that everything these days is on tape?
I think she made a tremendous mistake there. And this is not to say that there aren't some deplorables among Trump's supporters. There certainly are. David Duke, fine. Again, you know, there's some statistics that you can use to try and get a handle on that. But we see that there are some hate-filled people who, you know, spit on protesters, who punch protesters. We know that 7% of Trump supporters recognize that he's a racist, support him anyway. One poll that came out of South Carolina had 16% of Trump supporters agreeing with the statement that whites are a superior race. So there is that element among Trump supporters, an element of whites who in 2016 nevertheless endorsed the idea of racism and white supremacy. But that's not the majority of his supporters. And I think it's a mistake to talk about Trump's appeal in terms of an appeal to out-and-out bigots, or even as an appeal to what Hillary Clinton describes as the alt-right. Yeah, the alt-right exists. They're a reconstituted version of white supremacists. They call themselves white nationalists. Now they call themselves alt-right. Whatever. They're out there. But I think that Clinton made a mistake. And I think it was a political mistake, not just an analytic mistake. She made a mistake when she talked about Trump's racial appeals in terms of bigotry, because that allows most people to say to themselves, hey, I'm not a bigot, and I know I'm not a bigot. Therefore, what Clinton is saying doesn't apply to me, and indeed, she's insulted me by talking about me as a bigot. And I think that they're right to react that way. We need to begin to make a distinction between various forms of racism. There isn't just one racism out there. It's not just bigotry or nothing. Right? There's what I would call the strategic racism of people like Donald Trump, who, whether he's a bigot or not, and frankly, I think he is, but that's besides the point, whether he is or not, he has clearly made the cold, calculated decision that he can appeal to racial fears as a way to win votes. That's strategic racism. I think there's the structural racism that you see in terms of a society that has for centuries been organized along lines of race, that and that finds itself deeply entrenched in current distributions of power and wealth in society, from segregated suburbs to segregated boardrooms to what the U.S. Senate looks like, right? So there's that structural racism. I think there's also a pervasive cultural racism, a complex of ideas about race that says, in effect, whites are decent and hardworking and honorable and law-abiding, whereas non-whites tend to be criminal and lazy, highly emotional, given over to violence. That sort of cultural racism can sometimes be expressed in explicit statements, but more often it operates as a sort of a common sense. It operates in terms of news shows that disproportionately show people of color in stories about crime, and disproportionately shows whites in term as victims of natural disasters, right? This is a sort of cultural racism. What's happening is Democrats ought to be saying, Democrats are now, Hillary Clinton is now saying the problem is the bigots. No. The problem is racially fearful whites who continue to draw upon cultural common sense about race, cultural racism, when they understand what's happening in society, when they understand what's happening in their hometown, when they try and think about what happened to their jobs. And we need to reach out to those folks and we need to say, hey, pay attention to the power of these cultural stereotypes because they're wrong. They're false. Look across the racial division and see somebody who's just like you. Somebody who wants to take care of their children, somebody who wants to be secure in their retirement, somebody who values hard work and wants to make sure they raise good, decent, moral kids. Make that connection across race, reject cultural racism, and by all means, reject strategic racists.
What do you think the Democrats will learn from this as they move to the right and continue embracing Wall Street and policies that do not help people who are struggling?
Well, I think the initial move to the right came during the Clinton administration, and it came precisely because of how Bill Clinton decided he was going to respond to dog whistle politics. So Bill Clinton in 1992 looked at the ability of Republicans to really dominate the white electorate by racial appeals. And here, let me just throw in this fact that is just astounding. No Democratic candidate for president has won a majority of the white vote since 1964. So once the Republicans shift to dog whistling, they have captured a majority of the white vote in every single presidential election, beginning in 1968 up through the present. Bill Clinton looks at that and he says, we can't beat them, let's join them. And Bill Clinton runs his own dog whistle campaign when he introduces himself and Al Gore as New Democrats. It's two white men from the South. And what do they promise they're going to do? They're going to end welfare as a way of life. They're going to crack down on crime and they're going to rein in the federal government. And those are the dog whistle themes. Well, at the same time that Clinton does that and he ramps up the war on crime, he shreds welfare. He also turns his back on working people, on unions, and it starts to embrace Wall Street and big money. So this shift to the right of the Democratic Party comes as the Democrats begin to imitate dog whistle politics. Now, in the era of Hillary Clinton, I don't see her imitating dog whistle politics in the way that Bill did. I don't see her using anymore the language of super predators the way she did back in 1994. But on the other hand, over the intervening decades, the Democratic Party has become so interpenetrated by Wall Street money, and the Clinton camp in particular, so dependent on Wall Street money, that the Democrats simply have not extricated themselves from the sort of this dependency on big money. You saw an effort to do so in the person of Bernie Sanders. Mm. You saw the potential the incredible success that Bernie Sanders had at raising small donations. And this, I think, is a signal, a harbinger of where the Democratic Party needs to go. But in the meantime, Hillary Clinton is not going to go there unless pushed. So if she wins in November, she may learn the wrong lesson. That is, that you don't really have to talk about race seriously with the white working class, that you can get by with the aid of Wall Street. And I think a lot of us who are going to support her through November need to nevertheless continue to organize to say, after November, it's not enough that you won. You actually have to govern as a progressive. You actually have to help working people. You actually have to break your connections with Wall Street. And you need to shift the Democratic Party so that once more it's allied with working people rather than the 1%.
Yeah, it's a 1-2 punch with dog whistle politics and neoliberalism. Ian, we have about a minute left. You write, dog whistle politics is not going to evaporate on its own, not even under the sun of demographic change. I mean, we didn't get a chance to talk about your background. We'd love to have you back for that. But it took you a while to really get to this place and realize that these issues are really serious. So what are your thoughts on where we go from here?
Here's the realization that took me so long to break through to. I have been focused on race my entire life, and my focus has been on the harms that racism does to communities of color, and it does tremendous damage. But it took me a long time to recognize this isn't just about putting down people of color. Race is fundamentally a divide and conquer tactic of the very rich, and it has been used to harm all of us. And that's, I think, the paradigm shift that we need to grasp, that we all have a stake in ending racism, that racism is not something that's helping any of us unless we're part of the very rich, unless we're Donald Trump. It's actually the poison that is destroying our sense of commonality. And once we don't believe in us as a people, we no longer believe in the public. We no longer believe in the power of government to help us. And we give control of our society over to the very rich. That's the fundamental change, to see racism as a weapon against all of us.
Ian Haney-Lopez is professor of law at UC Berkeley, senior fellow at Demos, and author of the new book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Ian, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.